At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week. And this is a big week. It's Superman week. Superman is coming out in the movie theater. Fantastic Four is coming out in a few weeks. And honestly, there might be some comics that are coming out as well. I honestly don't know.
You know, we often talk about how comics actually are what make the comic book movies. And this week, we're showing up. We're showing out. Everybody, bring your stack to the movie theaters. Carry them wherever you go. It's our time.
It is our time. And it's also the Fantastic Four's time. So why don't we get into it with Fantastic Four First Steps, number one. From Marvel, written by Matt Fraction, art by Mark Buckingham. The conceit here is that this is a comic from inside the MCU. It is a retelling, documentary style, of the origin and first mission of the Fantastic Four. Of course, I don't want to spoil it too much. It's not. That's not actually what it is. But it is this team giving us a lot of groundwork that presumably we won't see in the movie, or we'll see in like smattering of news footage to set things up, because by the time the movie starts, the team is already established and it's 4 years on from when they were first introduced. So that all said, we got a great team on this. Matt Fraction doing some comic book writing. He's only sporadically done that over the past couple of years. Mark Buckingham, already great. So given this in-universe thing, how did it strike you, Justin?
Well, it's an interesting book, especially coming out before we've all seen the movie, because this book is one of those classic. I feel like you tell a story where you had there's a comic book novelization that came out before a movie and you picked it up and it spoiled some stuff. Back in the day.
I don't know. I do talk about the Krull adaptation a lot, but I don't think that spoiled too much.
Well, this one, I feel like I'm like, it's giving me a little too much of a window into the movie when I'm not ready to do that right now. Mm. So like, there's a little bit of that, but that's, you know, something that we can be a little bit mad about, but not super mad about, because this comic is interesting. It's telling a story. It has the Matt Fraction vibe that I feel like we've been missing in comics ever since he's been sort of stepped back from the business a bit. There's a fun sort of series of pull quotes throughout this that give us a nice window into these characters, which, since we haven't seen the movie yet, we have not gotten yet.
Like I said, I really like this team. I think this is a well put together package throughout. They do it magazine style, so we're getting the comic book retelling, but we're also getting interviews with Mr. Fantastic. We get like a very Tiger Beat style interview with Johnny Storm, other little interludes and ads there. So it's very cute. The thing that weirdly didn't quite hit for me, I love Mark Buckingham. There was something not working about his celebrity likenesses in this book that felt a little uncanny to me. Like, the action's good, the layouts are good, but I don't know, like, it didn't quite look like Vanessa Kirby, Pedro Pascal, Joseph Quinn. I mean, whatever. The Thing looks like The Thing, so we can't really complain too much there.
Well, and I feel like this is like, The Thing is like the classic comic booky thing, and then everyone else is movie versions, and then we get some real life photography of them in here as well. And it's sort of like, it's that thing of crossing over where you're like, I'm not comfortable, I'm not here with them yet. You know, these aren't my guys yet. And so we're a little bit on the outside here.
And I want to throw out one other thing, and I know it feels like I'm lumping on this book, which generally I liked and I enjoyed, and I think if you are interested in the movie, it's well worth the pickup. But There was a story on the Comics Beat that I heartily agree with about the visual design of the advertising for First Steps, that is supposed to be this retro future thing, but I think what Heidi at the Beat was getting at is it's all like a little too modern. Like they didn't get, she keeps pointing out throughout, they did not get Alex Ross to do any of the advertising for the movie, which feels like such a no-brainer. He's just this iconic artist that really captures the classic look of the characters. And I think it's the same thing with the visual design here in this book, where it's supposed to feel like something that comes out of the 1960s, but if it looks too modern, it's too glossy. There's too much like Photoshop filters going on in some of the backgrounds and things like that, where it doesn't feel like a lost artifact from 1964 or whatever year it's supposed to be. It feels like it came out today, and that's more
which is what did happen. That's what did happen, Alex. That's what I'm saying. Yes, it feels like a slight miss on the follow through of something like this from a tie-in perspective. And it's interesting because I do think there's another book that I would call Fantastic Four number one in this stack that we're going to talk about that I feel like is nailing that. But I don't want to spoil myself.
Yeah, we'll see what that is. Could be Fantastic Four number one. Could be number one Fantastic Four.
We don't know. That's the thing. We're at this part of the stack. We're not at that part of the stack, Alex.
Well, why don't we move from Fantastic Four back to Superman, who is celebrating this week. He's going nuts. He's beginning.
He's personally cutting pretty loose. Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy's out of control.
Superman Treasury 2025, Hero for All, number one from DC Comics, written by Dan Jurgens, art by Bruno Redondo. This is an oversized original story by this team that actually has nothing to do with the movie. It's just like a very classic Dan Jurgens throwing absolutely all of the iconic Superman stuff into, I don't know, first thing I thought was wood chipper, but that sounds really negative.
Well, there's a little wood chipper in here.
There's a little
like wood chipper. Like a tasteful wood chipper.
Yes, but it's a classic Superman adventure. They're fighting Cyborg Superman. They're fighting Proxima. Is that who it is?
Yes, Madam. No, that's not Proxima. No, it's Maxima.
Maxima. I don't know. There's a lot of X's going on in the 90s. Yes. Anyway, I was pleasantly surprised by this. I thought this would be like 10 pages of a Dan Jurgens, Bruno Redondo story, and then we get a couple of like pinups and news about the movie and then filler stories and like, here's another reprint of Action Comics number one. Nope. It's like full on mainlining Dan Jurgens classic writing alongside some really beautiful, as usual, Bruno Redondo art. So honestly, I was very pleasantly surprised and pleased by this. How about you?
Same. Like, the art is spectacular in this, and something that we, you know, Bruno Redondo, everyone is on to be very blunt about it, like he's out there as an artist everybody wants to see. We're amongst those people. To have him on a big Superman story that crosses through a lot of continuity, but to use your wood chipper analogy, if I may call it that.
No, please don't.
It does take it takes a lot of bits and pieces from Superman and puts them together in a way that definitely kept me guessing. And if this is like the official tie-in week for all of comicdom, I think this is very much a let's bring back some comic readers that haven't read comics in a while type tie-in, because it's just a great Superman story that you do have to know enough about. You can't just walk into this like you can the Fantastic Four issue we just talked about. It is like deep in continuity, but because it's rooted in that, we get a lot of great emotionality. Something that people also struggle with Superman, I feel like, who aren't reading something, some of the best stuff. They're like, what, this character, he's too strong. Where's my in on it? This comic has it, I feel like.
Yeah. Why don't we talk about the return of one of our favorite books? Pete, our co-host, is not here. He hates this book because it scares him too much.
Too scary for him.
Too scary for him. Just the right amount of scary for us. Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees, Rite of Spring, number one from IDW by Patrick Horvath. Now, if you didn't read the first series, we focused on a serial killer, adorable bear named Sam, who just got away with murder. Now we're picking up a couple of years later and turning the focus for most of the issue to the sister of the duck who was killed back in the first issue of the original Beneath the Trees. Yes, Justin?
I was gonna say, not a character we're like, we've been waiting for in a lot of ways. You know, it's not someone we've met.
No, exactly. But I thought this was phenomenal. It flips the perspective to this new character, but shows she is as set in her ways as Sam is. It builds the tension over the course of the book. I don't want to spoil too much, leading to a last page that I was like giddy over. The art is gorgeous throughout. This is just continues to be one of the best books on the stands. I'm so excited to see it back.
For those of you watching on YouTube, I'm in a murder place about to be killed. And even though I'm at the hands of a serial killer's attempts to kill me, I still have been given the ability to read a lot of comics here and way to stick to the routine, my killer. But this book is awesome. We loved the first series so much. We've talked about it a lot. But this continues it on, but comes at it from a completely different perspective, which is hard to do. To do what you've done, but come at it from the opposite direction is great. We get the same sort of malaise or melancholy look at this world, this sort of murder Richard Scarry's universe type thing. But I actually think, I'm curious what you think, Alex. This feels like it's taking a step away from that sort of first take premise that was there in the first series.
Yeah, I think so. I think what Horvath is doing here, like I touched on a little bit before, is the idea of patterns. Like, we already saw Sam's patterns. She builds up a need to kill, goes out of town, does it very methodically, breaks these people apart. A lot of the first series is about shaking that up thanks to the introduction of a new serial killer. Here we get to see this duck lady who does the same thing, and ostensibly she's trying to find her brother and what happened to her brother and get some closure there, but she's been stuck in these patterns in the same way. So it flips it. It gives us this new window character that we can identify with and we can root for, but at the same time, it jumbles things up, at least in terms of my feelings, because as a reader, you feel very conflicted when you're following a serial killer. You want Sam to get out of this one, but at the same time, she shouldn't, you know?
Yeah, she kill it. And she be killing. And it's also especially tricky to come upon sort of our central character, the murdered duck that everyone's talking about, that the sister's chasing. You know, that person we know is dead. Like, we know more about what's happening than the characters on the page. And that's often, like, not a great place or a difficult place to tell a story. But this just, it just ramps up the tension for where we get. And it also does a lot of great, you know, like I said, melancholic world building as we get to the big reveal on the last couple pages.
Great book. Do not miss it. And you're not going to believe this, Justin. Our next book is Fantastic Four, number one from Marvel.
But Alex, we've already covered this.
No, this is a different one. It's a different one. Written by Ryan North, art by Humberto Ramos. Ryan North is a little cheeky about it in the back matter, but it was basically a continuation of the run that he was already doing on Fantastic Four. However, one thing that we were a little worried about that we talked about with the last quote-unquote issue of his previous run was that was, for the most part, done in one issues. They present a premise, something science fiction-based, follow it through, end at the end. They had a couple of two-parters in there, but for the most part, it was these one-and-dones, which is great. Would that work here? Spoiler, this is not a one and done. This is kicking off an ongoing story where we get the Fantastic Four are attacking Doom. It's in continuity, so he is the emperor of the Marvel Universe. They lose, and Doom shoots them to four different places in time. So now they're lost in time, and they got to figure out a way back to each other. Justin, seemed like you had some thoughts about this when we were talking about the first Teps comic.
If you're going to give one Fantastic Four one issue to a new comic reader on this a couple weeks before the Fantastic Four movie comes out, I think this is the comic to give them. I feel like this does a great job of setting up the characters, giving you the relationships, but also giving you just a great story that feels like a classic early run Fantastic Four story. It's hooked into a big adventure. You don't need to know too much about the Emperor Doom stuff that's going on in the main comics. But it also has enough of the flavor of Ryan North's run of rooted in science, or like at least an interesting idea that these characters can rally around. In this case, it's something called the Forever Stone that I won't spoil, but I thought was awesome, and able to have that sort of science-based thing without it being feeling a little more all ages, which I feel like is something that a lot of people criticize the previous Ryan North run for. I don't think that's a valid criticism. I loved it, and this is even better, though, I think.
I totally agree with you. You know, a drum that I beat pretty often is that the
you
comic
do is, it's so hard to get you to put it down to podcast.
I know.
Stop it with the drum.
I paid so much money for that drum set and the lessons. I gotta like get my money back somehow.
Parumpa pum pum parum pum pum pum. Alex and his drum.
Yes, it drives me up the wall when there is a new movie or a TV show coming out, and the comic book industry always has this tendency to be like, oh, great news. There's a Hulk movie coming out. Hulk is now red, and he just works at a coffee shop, and that's it. And it has, like, literally nothing to do with the movie. So they launch a new number one, and it just does not tie in. It's this wall for readers, I think, instead of inviting them in.
The coffee shop's in hell, readers. It's like, okay, I don't know how to connect this with the
and
movie.
I was worried about this. I was worried because when I heard the premise of like, great news, there's a new Fantastic Four movie coming. We have a new Fantastic Four number one. Pick it up. The team is fighting Emperor Doom for the One World Under Doom storyline that is 8 months in at this point. And also they're going to be separated in time and not working together as a team. But I think you're 100% right, because all you need to know is they're fighting Dr. Doom. Like, the One World Under Doom stuff really doesn't matter at all for this issue. And then it just sets up who each of these characters are, what their skill sets are, what they're about, nails their personalities. So you're absolutely right. It's not the circumstances of the movie at all, but it tells us who these people are. And yeah, I would be hooked on this. I'd be like, oh, these are cool. I want these characters to get out of this situation that they're stuck in, because it's fun. It's emotional. The art's great from Umberto Ramos. So great first issue.
I would be hooked. I am hooked. How do you feel about this cover? Like, it's a very, honestly, I feel like this is the cover. This should be the cover of the other book. Mm-hmm. This has very like magazine cover vibes to it. I feel like.
I don't like it. I don't like this cover. I think there's so many things that I don't love about it, not to lump on it too much, but like, Reed Richards in the background, I guess, is fine, except it really seems to be emphasizing the fact that he has a lack of genitals. Invisible Woman is way too front and center and covering too much of the cover. I also don't know why there's a big red sun behind her. Thing seems to be like stuck in some bushes at the bottom and being like, whoa, check out her crotch. And there's it's busy and
a classic quote from the Thing.
Yes,
he has like three quotes. It's clobbering time. Whoa, check out her crotch, and something about Yancey Street.
We'll find out what that is later, I guess.
Yeah.
Why don't we move on and talk about Trinity, Daughter of Wonder Woman, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Belen Ortega. There are three Trinities at three different points in her history who have lost a bunch of superpowered corgis in time. This issue, the middle Trinity goes to visit Jason Todd right before he dies in Death of a Family to get a bat corgi. Very awkward, but here's something I was surprised about. The first issue ended, spoiler here, and I should put a blanket spoiler warning for this, everything, ended with the reveal that this book is going to probably be about Steve Trevor returning to life. That's actually like the big thing that's going on in the background here. This issue is not about that. In fact, it is a really cute, sweet romance between teen Jason Todd and teen Trinity. It's adorable.
It is. And, you know, I love this. I feel like this continues the Trinity tone that we've gotten all of the backups and the Wonder Woman stories, something that I didn't think this book was going to do. But that leaves me with, can this book just be this? Can this character that has so much potentiality or so much like continuity weight on her shoulders just keep doing these like really sweet, interesting, lighthearted adventure stories?
I hope so. I think probably not, because it's Tom King, you know, and even in this issue, he creates a level of pathos and poignancy based on the fact that, like, we know Jason is about to go and get killed, something that they're very explicit about throughout the issue. But it is still sweet. It's still very delightful throughout. I think we are, even with the Steve Trevor thing, though, in the first issue, that was still, there was a lightness to it, even though he was approaching the three fates. So I hope so. I mean, I think there's really a place for a all-ages comedy YA-focused book on the stands.
And it may be that what...
I did on an up note there,
yes. But please, and like always in podcasting, say your punctuation, period. Because people really like to hear, comma, from us, comma, exactly what we mean, exclamation point. But what I was trying to say is maybe that is the idea behind this issue specifically, that Jason Todd is a character that is just like literally ripe, falling off the branch continuity-wise. And that's where our story is set. And this romance is in the shadow of that. In the same way that Trinity, a character, is in the shadow of Diana, Wonder Woman, in a way, and how she came to be and what she means for the DC universe. That's sort of what Tom King's playing with here.
What if everything you've been taught about happiness is wrong? We chase careers, approval, more stuff, hoping it'll finally make us feel fulfilled, but it never sticks. What if happiness isn't out there, but already inside you, just waiting to be unlocked? Discover the book, The Happiness Experiment. Every person has a unique happiness type, and when you understand yours, everything shifts. You'll stop chasing and start creating joy on your own terms. Discover your happiness type with a free happiness type assessment. Go to myhappinesstype.com. That's myhappinesstype.com. It takes just a minute and it might change your life. Then grab your copy of The Happiness Experiment at Books A Million. This isn't just a book, it's a practical framework, a journey inward. It's a tool to help you reconnect with the happiness that's been waiting inside you all along. Pick up The Happiness Experiment and start your happiness experiment today.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Archie meets Jay and Silent Bob, number one from Archie Comics, written by Kevin Smith, art by Fernando Ruiz. Per the title, exactly what you think happens. Archie gets a job at the Quick Stop. They go to a Josie and the Pussycats concert. The thing that I was not expecting is this is way more in the Jay and Silent Bob universe world than the Archie world. There's cursing, there's raunchiness, there's drugs. I thought we were going to get them like cleaning it down a little bit. They did not.
They did not. And you know, it's like, you ever, like, what's a movie that you, when you were a kid, you watch with your parents and you were like, oh man, I don't like this. I'm watching this with my parents. I have this sex scene or this like horrifying violence is making everyone uncomfortable because we're watching it together. That's what this book feels like to me. And not to be like a prude about it, because I like both of these things. But together, it's a total mismatch in a way that I feel like Archie versus Predator, they fixed that. They got that one right. And this one feels wrong in a way that I'm like, yucky.
Well, I'll full disclosure, Kevin Smith is somebody that, I don't know, I would say whenever Clerks came out like 20 years ago, I was like, this is the best. I love this. And
yeah,
it's not for me anymore. I've sort of grown away from that. I know there are a lot of people, particularly in our comic book club Discord, who are super psyched about this book, and I hope they enjoy it. But definitely going into it, I was like, I don't know about this one. I don't know if this is for me. I will say it's pretty packed with jokes. Like, Kevin Smith does get the Archie Comics multiple jokes per page thing going on. The thing that threw me more than anything else is the deep continuity with the Askewniverse and the Clerks series, particularly, like, I guess this is a spoiler, but Dante died, I guess, in Clerks 3? Something, I have not seen Clerks 3, something I was not aware of, and I was like, oh my god, did the actor die? And I didn't know about it, and I looked it up, and I was like, he's not dead, what is going on here?
It has the human died energy to the whole story. I'm like, oh god, I feel awful, and I was like, wait a second, no, I don't need to feel so bad. Why is this about a character who died?
Yeah, I'm not sure why they needed to do that necessarily, because the Archie thing is clearly, like, iconic and timeless, so why not hit the most iconic and timeless version of the Askewniverse as well? I don't know why we needed to pay tribute to Dante in particular. Confusing.
I will say the art was really cool. It was cool to see the Clerks, the Askewverse, sort of Archie-ized as we get in this. And there is some fun stuff in here. And I think we read a Kevin Smith book a couple weeks ago, I think in the Spider-Verse adjacent thing. He had a story in a book. Maybe it was a Spider annual. But and it was really funny, and I highlighted, like, oh, Kevin Smith sort of still has his swing when it comes to writing comedy and comics. And this, you can feel that a little bit. The continuity is turned up so high on the Askewverse stuff that it feels a little strange, especially mixed with the total mismatch of Archie.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about Marvel Swimsuit Special, Friends, Foes, and Rivals, number one from Marvel, written by Tim Seeley and Tony Fleece, art by Nick Bradshaw and Rochelle Rosenberg. Got a framing story from Seeley and
big time framing story
about how Roxxon has put out an AI version of a swimsuit special, and the heroes decide to fight back by creating their own authentic swimsuit special. And of course, you get pinups peppered throughout. Here's the positive I'll say is I thought the framing story was a lot of fun. Seeley and Fleece clearly know their stuff here. Like, they went in on this sort of thing in Local Man over on Image Comics, so they're definitely playing all of the beats correctly right here and setting up ridiculous things like Cloak and Dagger being like, I don't know, should we do a swimsuit pinup, which is very funny. The punchline with the Punisher at the end was great, I thought. Made me laugh out loud. I want to throw something out about the pinups, and I know this is probably going to come off wrong. I'm actually very happy Pete is not here, because he would take this entirely the wrong way. This book is dangerously levels of unhorny, and it should be way hornier. Like, the pinups, very specifically. Like, there's one or two in there. I thought Mahmouda's Rara's pinup of Black Cat and Spidey.
Love was about to highlight that, my guy.
That's great. These things should be, like, hilariously over the top, ridiculous, raunchy. That's what we should be channeling with a swimsuit special. This feels so, I'm blanking on the right word to use, but, like, it feels so homogenized. And I think that comes through in particular, the one that stood out to me, and this is not to lump on an artist, but there's a pinup of Elsa Bloodstone doing the classic, like, what's the suntan oil baby thing?
The sort of pulled bikini bottom by a dog.
In this case, it's Jeff the Land Shark pulling her bikini bottom down with Deadpool in the background kind of being blocked. But she has, like, full-on total swimsuit. It's just Jeff sort of, like, pulling it a little bit. And I do not need to see Elsa Bloodstone's butt. But there's a level of, like, well, we can't show that. We're Disney. We can't show that. That everything is, like, I don't know. They're just like, great, I'm glad you guys are having fun by the pool, you know?
Another classic Alex Zalwin review of a comic. Not horny enough, America. Do you, please.
Do you disagree?
I mean, I really like the framing story here. I agree with you specifically for the joke that they're setting up here, that I think you're right. And this strikes me as something where the pinups sort of came first, perhaps, mostly, mm-hmm. where they were like, let's do a swimsuit issue. Let's get all these artists to do great, like, one-page swimsuit pages, splash pages. And then the story came around it. So that it is like about that. I will say the Elsa Bloodstone image you're describing, they weirdly have very strong tan lines on her, without showing her butt. So I don't know how about those tan lines, Alex? Is that doing it for you? I guess not.
It's not about doing it for me or anything like that. Like it.
Okay.
Thinking back, this was a prime thing in the 90s and 2000s when they were trying to channel like Maxim and FHM and all of this stuff. To bring it back now in the current era that Marvel is in, I do not think they could do it right. That's all.
Yeah, that's fair. And it is funny to take something that was unabashedly just horny, taking characters that like are not the Punisher famously, that is what they're playing with here with the joke, and doing that and finding a way to still do it, but they've since softened their stance on the idea of a swimsuit issue, is I think what you're highlighting is like, oh, there is again something here that doesn't quite match up. But I still like this. I do think the framing story helps, like, just comic readers enjoy this more than just being like, wow, that is one hot cloak and dagger. But that cloak and dagger pinup is also very good. And we'll be out with our horny rankings here in a couple of weeks.
Can I make really one more point, not to belabor this, but just to contrast it with what DC does on their variant covers, which we've joked about a lot, but like the sweater weather covers are coming up in October. They have this thing called Pumpkin Spicy. I think they do it the right way. Like, they do it where you have, like, you laugh out loud at the audaciousness of what they're doing, and they are a little sexy, but it's also silly because you got them in these tiny little bikinis and everything. They're outrageously over the top, and that's what that should be channeling. This is not. Anyway.
Hornier, we say. Put it on the cover.
Pete isn't here, but I do want to speak for him. Pete actually sent me a text being like, me horny, me want hornier comic, yum yum, is what Pete said. So.
And you know it's Pete when he signs off with his signature, yum yum.
Absolute Superman number 9 from DC Comics, written by Jason Aaron, art by Rafa Sandoval and Fico Asio. In this issue, Kal-El has been taken in by the Omega Men after getting hit with some kryptonite bullets and is maybe joining them to fight back against the Lazarus Corporation. What'd you think, Justin?
I really like this comic. Continue. This is the most, like, dangerous or fraught of all of the Absolute books. Like, Absolute Superman was straight up dying at the end of last issue, and it continues in this issue, but he's able to get out of it in a way that...
Ooh. Yeah. Yes, I'm going to start talking because the dog... my dogs are barking.
So. My dog is saying not horny enough. That's what he's mad about still. But what I was saying is, like, this is the stakes are always so high in this comic, both philosophically and emotionally for the characters, and the danger that Kal-El is in always in this comic. I like the way they've been able to put Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, and Kal-El in different places, and they still get to come together. And yeah, I don't know what's going to happen every issue.
I really like this as well. This is really well done. My one little qualm with it is, even though I really like both Rafa Sandoval and Fico Asio, it was a bummer to see something from the Absolute line, which is such a art-forward line, where they were having essentially fill-in artists. I understand they need to make a monthly schedule, and that's going to happen, but I think, like...
It's summer, Alex. Everyone's taking a break.
Everybody's taking a break. I don't know. Over in to Absolute Batman, like, they've had this very intentional switch up of the artists, where we've talked about this before, like, Gabriel Walta came in for a flashback issue, or Marcos Martin came in for a two-part Mr. Freeze arc. Here, getting it in the same issue, they're Rafa and Fico, I don't know either of them, but Rafa and Fico are a little bit of a mismatch in terms of the art, so that threw me when they went from page to page, particularly because it's not like switching between flashback sequences. It's not changing it up in any way. So I hope this is a one-time thing. I hope going forward we get consistent artists for the issues, because that's been a really standout of the Absolute line so far.
Agreed.
Rick and Morty versus the Universe, number one from Odie Press, written by Daniel Kibblesmith, art by Jared Williams. The big headline here is this is the first event series from the Rick and Morty franchise over at Oni Press. I will say it's like a lighter event where we're getting, I think, a four-issue series and then a couple of one-shot spinoffs, all written by Daniel Kibblesmith. But this is very fun. We get Rick and Morty taking the universe, the little personification of the universe, to his bachelor party because he's marrying another universe. Yeah, it gets raunchy, it gets bad, things go bad. It really channels the tone of the TV show. But I think the real plus up that Daniel Kibblesmith does here is he leans into it being a comic book. Like, he's definitely riffing off Crisis on Infinite Earths without specifically aping it, but he really plays with the form here in a nice way. So I had a really good time with this one.
It's able to be very comic booky, but not get caught up in creating a bunch of continuity for a crossover where we don't really need that at all. And it's also really funny, like you said, channels the show. But there is some pathos here that I think is really working in a great way. And, you know, I don't watch the show a ton, but especially this season of Rick and Morty has been sort of very quietly taken in, I feel like, by fans. So you don't hear a lot of news about it. Even the fact that wasn't there a James Gunn, Zack Snyder crossover episode that just
happened? That was just this week. It was, in my opinion, not great. And so, I mean,
maybe that's why.
This is very much side to this issue, but it was bothering me a lot because, like, Rick and Morty has been pretty good about advertising, where whenever they do some sort of advertising thing, they hate to be there. Like, that is clearly, like, they're working against it. Obviously, they're advertising the thing, but at the same time, they're like, this is gross, what are we doing? This episode felt a little sweaty. Like, it was definitely, James Gunn is the villain of the episode, but it was definitely like, hey, there's a big movie coming out. Can you guys do an episode featuring James Gunn and Zack Snyder talking about Superman? And they're like, no problem, let's do it. And I don't know, just the whole thing made me very, very uncomfortable watching it. But it's definitely been like, even beyond that, very quiet. I was also thinking about 7 years ago, people were having riots at McDonald's over a tie-in sauce, and now you would not know that they are 7 episodes into a new season. It's weird.
It is weird. But this comic, I think, is if you're feeling like you need something different and you're a fan of the show but haven't read the comics, I think this is a great issue to dive in on.
Ultimate Spider-Man Incursion, number 2 from Marvel, written by Dennis Capp and Cody Ziegler, art by Jonas Scharf. Miles Morales is tracking his baby sister who has gotten lost in the Ultimate Universe. This issue, he heads with Wasp and Ant-Man to Wakanda. So, of course, encounters the characters from Ultimate Black Panther there, well as some more twists and turns. I like the team on this, and I really want to like this, but I don't know. This is not working for me.
I agree with you. And here's what my takeaway from it was. Like, the Ultimate Universe is such a clock. It's such a, like, tight package moving in one direction. And this comic feels like it's just right at a slightly different party than the rest of the rest of the comics in this. Or it's coming in late, and it feels like it wasn't part of the plan. And I think it's the danger when you make a story that is so time-dependent. Each issue in the Ultimate Universe, it happens as the months are progressing, it's building towards something. When you try to add something in that wasn't there in the original plan, it feels hard to match. It feels hard to slot in. And I think that's what this book is suffering from for me.
Yeah, this is a little bit external, but I think, like, I don't know how this helps Miles Morales' story necessarily, particularly because the first issue had him just, like, checking windows in New York City with the two Spider-Men and the two other Spider-Men. And this issue very casually has Black Panther being like, oh, the Ultimates, I've always wanted to meet them, where yeah. It's just this, like, Do they talk like that? Is that, like, and these are two writers who know this stuff, which is the weirdest yeah. part to me. The other part, which I think you were getting at, is these books are so separate and we know they're going to crash together at some point, but this feels like a little too early, you know?
Right.
Like
it's just off a little bit in its, the way that it's sort of positioned. And like, it's a shame because I feel like this is a great, Miles is a great character to mm-hmm. inject here, because he's someone who came from the Ultimate Universe into the regular universe. Now he's back. So there's an interesting thing there. He's in cursing in the opposite direction mm-hmm. always. And so that's a cool idea, but they don't quite have the space to get there, I don't think.
Batman Dark Patterns, number 8 from DC Comics, written by Dan Waters, art by Hayden Sherman. This is continuing the, oh my God, I blocked the name of the arc, but a new arc where he's tracking down the Red Hood gang. Great book. This is maybe the best Batman book on the stands, I think.
Wow, strong take. I do enjoy this book as well. The art specifically is unbelievable. The perspectives that I think we're getting all, and even though we're getting different arcs, I feel like the perspective, interest in Gotham City perspective stays true. We get so many like wide panels featuring Batman with Gotham like blowing out in the background. It's really cool. From the story perspective, we're focused on a series of murders is what this book's all about. But we keep going back to this mortician, this mm-hmm. guy in the morgue who like is being weird. And even later, they're like, "Have you heard about him? He did a bunch of fucked up stuff in Florida." And I was like, "Ooh, what's that?" And they're like, "Never mind, don't have time." I was like, "What?" That's what I want to know about. Yeah. So that's straight. It's a little bit woolly from covering some different things, but there's a great sequence where Batman gets shot that is like really well done, like mm-hmm. a textbook way of showing something in a very Batman way. I like the where this is going. The last story, this one's called Pareidolia.
There you go.
Part 2. I don't know what that word means, but I will
look it up. They described it in the last issue. It was seeing patterns that may or may not be there. So it was a little harder to parse how that ties into this issue versus the last issue, other than Batman is going crazy and he's taking the same route every night. This was in a book that's very good. I think this is the least issue so far, but it's still excellently done.
Well, and see, I actually like the way where the story ends, and I'm curious how it's going to go, talking yeah. about, like, revisiting legacy and being stuck in a place. Like you're saying, Batman is stuck in this pattern, dark pattern, may I? and it seems like the character we meet here is also doing that, and their patterns are about to meet. And that's a cool idea, and that in the art makes this not anything I felt like was a downbeat on the series as a whole.
The Toxic Avenger comics, number 1 from Ahoy Comics, written by Matt Boris, art by Fred Harper. This is a new book set in the same continuity as the ongoing Toxic Avenger comic book, where each issue they're going to focus on a different genre. This one is a horror genre with a little riff on Something is Killing the Children, except Toxic Avenger style. What'd you think about this, Justin?
I feel like this comic or this area of the universe here has been really growing well. Like, I feel like they're making a lot of strides issue by issue, even though this is a number one. It's not the same exact thing, but I just like the way this universe is moving. I feel like it feels topical. It feels like there's some fun in here and a comedy focus, while even though it is a horror focus and a horrifying story all the way. Like, this issue specifically is like super dark, but I do think it's really bringing in the different tones that are always there for the Toxic Avenger and finding a way to make it really compelling in a comic.
I really like this as well. I mean, if you're liking the ongoing Toxic Venture comic, this is more of that. I was surprised they did horror for the first one. Maybe it was a way of easing people into the series, because tonally it only feels a couple of degrees away from what they're doing anyway. So I would have liked maybe even a bigger, weirder swing for the first issue, but that's coming and that's what they're going for. The Uncanny X-Men, number 17 from Marvel, written by Gail Simone, art by Luciano Vecchio. This issue, a new movie called Murder Me Mutina comes out, which causes a lot of panic in the mutant community. The kids, the outliers, I think, I don't know, I should know their name by now, go to see the movie and end up tangling with Mutina herself, introducing this new character. What'd you think, Justin?
I continue to like this series. This issue is different than what we just had, a four issue arc, really getting into sort of bigger ideas for this series in general and these new characters. And I really like the way they've carved out this little corner, this weird corner of the X-Men universe for these characters. And this reminds me of classic X-Men stories where they go on like a little jaunt and things get crazy after that. Something that I feel like has been missing from so much of Krakoa and from the Ashes and all of that. This has some nice flavor to it, and I just like the way this is developing.
I like this as well, and I like the focus of this issue. Occasionally, this title has been tackling too many things at the same time, but it is very funny to me that we have the main X-Men, Wolverine, Rogue, Gambit, Nightcrawler, pretty much every issue are like, whew, what's going on with those kids? I don't know. Well, time to keep working on this farm.
So much there. They're like, what's going on with those kids? Like, oh, they're all the way across the field. Ugh, I hope they're okay. And I'm like, go check on them.
Do something.
They're your friends. They're also your students, sort of. So, like, what? Go hang out with them. It's shocking how much of this book just isn't focused on that core team of X-Men you just named.
Yeah.
It's wild. And, like, I'm sure it's going to rebalance a little bit, and it's going to be, like, 18. But this is really, if you haven't been reading it and you like, say, New Mutants or any of the, or classic X-Men, Kitty Pryde era, like, this is that, just a modern version of that. Like, get in there, and because it's good and it's introducing new characters that are working, I think.
Action Comics 1088 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid, art by Skylar Patridge. This takes place in the Smallville days when Superboy has just been introduced to the world. He's wrapping his head around that and meanwhile dealing with some big things going down in Smallville, leading to some interesting revelations that I wonder will have implications for Superman's future. I guess we'll see. What do you think about this issue?
I like this stuff. I think, you know, there's so much about Superman. We're getting a lot of Superman stories that are like being definitional right now because of the movie and because of just it's the summer of Superman. We're all living in it, and this is doing that as well from the Superboy side of things. And we still, this, what I like about this comic is it finds new stuff. There's so much in here of him being like, I can't let this bully get me because he will break his hand on my face. So I have to defuse the situation. You get this sort of like anxious young Superman trying to be everything all at once, which is a big part of the character and something that I don't think we touch on a lot. Seeing him develop into the like guy who's feeling bad that he can't be everywhere all the time, which I think is a big defining quality of our modern Superman in the comics.
Yeah, this is a great team book. Mark Waid knows exactly what he's doing, both with Superman and this style of storytelling. Skylar Patridge's art is great, just like very iconic and classic, like you were getting at. So, really good book. The Unchosen, number one from Image Comics by David Marquez. This is focusing on a world where it's basically like an X-Men world where a bunch of people have powers. There is one girl who has powers that when they woke up, they basically cause the apocalypse. We're jumping, I think, backward and forward in time throughout this issue to tell this story. Interesting debut from The writing and art perspective by David Marquez. Previously, we know him from Art On and Uncanny X-Men, among other things. What'd you think about this one, Justin?
This book feels like a 90s Image comic, like a sort of Top Cow style comic. And that's a strong flavor of comic. So I feel like if that's something you, especially in the summer, it reminds me of being a kid. And when Image first started, my brother and I were like, had ordered the Image first comics coming in the mail. And we didn't realize how long it takes for them to come in the mail. So every day we would run out to the mailbox and be like, they're here. Oh no, it's just not anything we care about because we're kids and we don't understand mail. But this book has that exact vibe to it, I feel like.
David Marquez's art is always great. Story-wise, this was a little hard for me to follow because of the time jumps and because I don't know these characters. It feels like this is not necessarily a doc, but it's jumping right into the middle, so you're doing a little bit of catch-up throughout the issue. But the powers are interesting and the art is clear.
It's a little slingshotty. I agree with you there. And the characters, you're like, they're being coy, something that I think can be hard to deal with, and they're not telling everybody everything. So I do think with a little more time, it will be a little more clear what's happening and how to get on board.
Magic, number 7 from Marvel, written by Ashley Allen, art by Germán Peralta. This is kicking off the second arc of this title as Magic visits a secret society that Danny Moonstar is part of that is devoted to taking down this character, Liminal, who we thought was eliminated in the first arc. Oops, not exactly. He's actually possessed one of Magic's friends. I continue to really like this title. This issue is a little more complicated because it's dealing with a lot of continuity from the previous arc, but there's still so many interesting ideas on the table. I'm curious to follow it more going forward.
Yes, I love this comic. This is right up there with the Storm comic as top-tier X-Men book on the stands. And I like the continuity because I'm in it. I'm a fan of it. But this book also introduces a lot of new characters and new ideas that I do think, I hope they stick with because it, first off, it feels like they are. They take the time to really meet everybody from a Mickey Mouse Club standpoint of like, hi, I'm blank, and here's what the part of the scary thing that I do. So that's cool. And this book also takes creative swings in a way that I think really are needed in the X-Men universe right now.
Batman and Robin, number 23 from DC Comics, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Miguel Mendoza. We had PKJ on the live show just this past week, so go and listen to that.
Yeah.
We talk quite a bit about this book. But if you haven't been keeping up, Batman is fighting an old enemy from his past named Memento. And it all really comes to a head here as we find out, or I think we find out, what Memento is and what Memento wants. Great book, very trippy. I always find it interesting when Batman is fighting supernatural things because he's like, I don't believe in that, even though he's clearly seen it with his eyes 1 billion times. So it's always like there's a good bit of tension going on there with that sort of thing where Batman is refusing to believe what he definitely sees with his eyes, what he should know is true based on all of his experience with the universe. He's in over his head, which is always a good place to put Batman.
Yeah, and this goes deep on it. What Philip Kennedy Johnson does best is committing hard to a big premise. And I think the thing that works here, especially when it comes to Batman dealing with supernatural, is having the demon be there and really like be the window there where that he can be sort of like, no, I assure you this is real. Because the thing I don't think we need here is Batman being like, what is this about? Is this real? And like, because I think that can get really monotonous, and it just goes right at it and puts Batman in this place. And another thing about this, not to be the Pete of the podcast today, but this cover really starts the story. The story's happening on the cover. We get some word balloon, something I feel like we don't see very often. And it got me, it was such a nice ramp into what was happening, I feel like.
Yeah. The Power Fantasy, number 10 from Image Comics, written by Kieran Gillen, art by Casper Wingard. Picking up after the cliffhanger of the last issue, we know that one of our characters died many years ago and has been replaced. So over the course of this issue, we deal with what that means in a very, to call back earlier the podcast, very horny manner.
Like, horny. This hit the horny spot on Alex, which is what he calls it.
I was so relieved.
Yes. Relieved is exactly the feeling you want to have next to relief.
Meanwhile, the rest of the superpower cast is dealing with the revelation that we have potentially a new superpower entering the mix. And I got to tell you, you know, we talked to Kieran and Casper back at New York Comic Con about how they had a pretty long plan for this title. This issue, it feels like it's all going to fall apart, like in the next two issues or something like that. That's at least the thing that I got from it. And that's, that tension is great. That nervousness is great because we know that if these characters meet, the world dies and they are heading towards a meeting.
A big meet, a big confrontation. This feels like the chess pieces. I'm not a chess player, but when the chess pieces are all gathered around one particular thing, that's bad, right? That means you're about to lose and the whole game's going to get blown up, I believe. So that's what we're getting to here. This is a comic, though, that I also feel like I need to reread from the beginning and just see the lattice a little bit. And as I was reading, I was like, go before the next issue, go back and reread all of them because it's, you know, it's there. The matrix surrounding this book is there. And to reread it will just, I feel like you'll, we'll get more out of every single panel here.
The there was a couple of issues back in the first page of the title page. They put like a little explainer about all the characters and their status quo. And I was like, oh, this is great. Now I can get right into it. And they've never done that again. They really got to put that every issue. It would be very, very helpful just because like this title is great. And I agree with you that like we read a lot of comics. This comes out once a month or so. It is hard to remember exactly who everybody is and where they're coming from. So this is something that needs that little recap at the beginning. Or go back and read it every single month.
That's what I'm going to do.
Fire and Ice, When Hell Freezes Over, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Joanne Starr, art by Stephen Byrne. Lots of stuff going on in this book as everybody has had their minds switched, except for Fire and Ice, who are supposedly back in their bodies, but also in hell, trying to put everything straight. There's some twists and turns in this issue, leading to a big confrontation. I continue to really like this book. I think it's fun. It's funny.
Yeah.
But they're working in a nice bunch of emotion with some of the characters at the same time. And there's even an appearance by Gorilla Grodd that doesn't make sense continuity-wise with what's going on in Justice League, which would normally bother me, but I really liked it here.
They do the dance. We get the references to, like, here's what's happening here. Gorilla Grodd's superpower. That's why he's looking weird and being weird, and why he vanishes in the middle of out of nowhere. But I think this book is doing a lot and is able to come in quickly on a lot of big ideas. Like, the fact that we jump in and, like, remember, everyone's Freaky Friday'd, and a lot of the sort of supporting characters in this title are where we learn that, and then we get into the bigger emotionality happening with Fire and Ice on their own side of the comic in hell, just like that Hulk book we talked about earlier. So this stuff is it's working, it's fun, and it's balancing the tones really well.
Uncanny Valley, number 10 for Boom Studios, written by Tony Fleece, art by Dave Wachter. This is the final issue of this title about the cartoon world trying to take over the real world. We've got some wild swings in this book, like public domain Mickey Mouse or Steamboat Willie, if you will, showing up. But it all comes down to this as our main character deals with his cartoon human mixed heritage. This is a great series, really impressed. Nothing against Tony Fleece, but I continue even in this last issue to be wildly impressed with what Dave Wachter pulled off here art-wise, mixing different cartoon styles and characters with a more realistic style, sometimes on the same page. There's some huge battle scenes in this last issue that are insanely impressive as well. So just, I really like the story here, but visually this blew it out of the water.
Yeah, I mean, we even get sort of the real world characters being cartoony in this, which is like the ultimate combining of styles that I think works. Great reveal here that I'm sure we all had when it comes to who the main character's father is, especially Pete. Really missing Pete to have his take on the idea here. I won't say it, but it is really fun. And really sweet. Like, this comic wore its heart on its sleeve in a great way from beginning to end. And I think this ends in a really nice place. I would like to come back to this world and do sort of a more, there's, I do think this story has the he's the one, we have to get him, that type of framing for the story, and something that I think we've seen a lot before. So I think a new story that pushes in a different direction would really pop, I think.
Transformers number 22 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Daniel Warren Johnson, art by Jorge Corona. I will note here, since the last time we talked about Transformers, officially DWJ is leaving the title. 24 is his last issue, and starting with issue 25, Robert Kirkman and Dan Mora are taking over as the new team of the title, which should be interesting. Not to keep talking about Pete, he's the one who loves this, talks about it. It's bringing back to his childhood, aka the only time he was ever happy, puts him in a nostalgia bath, aka the only place he's ever happy. In this issue, we're the wrong people talking about this, I guess. I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff that happens with the Autobots and the Decepticons, and at the end of the issue, where they're like, it's all come down to this, the final showdown in Chicago. And legitimately, my reaction is like, final showdown for what? Like, what has been happening here that they're showing down about in Chicago? I don't understand. I'm so sorry. I know so many people like this book, but like, I just, there's something here that, there's a lot of things here that are just not working for me.
Well, and I think it just feels like the book has been one big conversation that's just been Optimus being like, I'm dying, but we gotta really fight. And then everybody keeps dying, and then another Autobot shows up. He's like, I'm here. And they're like, great. And then he's murdered or she's killed. It's like, we have to go back. And then it's like, where? Go through the portal. The wrong guy went through the portal. Oh, no. And it's like, it feels very, I guess it's, maybe it's in, it works if you are literally sitting in the nostalgia bath and can speak to all of these moments just as you have working knowledge of it. Because I don't feel like I don't know what's happening. It just feels so similar or one note. And like in this issue, Optimus is like dying again. And then another dude who's like Optimus, but with a different trailer, stands up, and I'm like, what's he doing? What's his deal? He's like a slightly more Optimus, more Prime. Yeah. And we do get some things about like he goes to the Prime world where Primes go after they die, I guess. And we get a human who's like taking the mantle. So there's like moves happening here. It's just a bit of a wash to me. Tell me why I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm wrong, world.
I thought you wanted me to tell you why you're wrong. And no,
well, you agree with me, unfortunately, so you can't tell me why I'm wrong.
Can I say something horrible that'll make people instantly unsubscribe from this podcast? I don't think it's necessarily better, but this comic makes me miss at least the mission-based plot of the Michael Bay Transformers movies, because like it just,
wow, that's
terrible.
A nasty statement.
It is. They're awful movies, but at least the big, like, we have to get to the, we got to get to Stonehenge because they're going to open a portal to bring Unicron to Earth. At least I'm like, okay, I understand this is nonsense and it's terrible and it's terribly filmed and the characters are all terrible, but at least like there's a clear thing I could hold on to. And I like Daniel Warren Johnson and I like Jorge Corona, and there's nothing like that. Like I was saying at the beginning, I don't know why they're going to Chicago. I don't know why they're having a showdown other than they hate each other. There's a lack of stakes and focus there that I'm hoping Robert Kirkman brings to the title. Most likely, which I will also like, he'll bring some weird little guy that he focuses on every couple of pages, and I'll be like, that's good.
But, wow, you want your own little Void rival in here. to ride with.
I do. My own scuxoid. But I guess we'll see what happens. Anyway, Dark Regards, number 3 from Odie Press, written by Dave Hill, art by Artyom Topalin. We are following the semi-true story of Dave Hill and the time he started a metal band called Witch Taint that brought a bunch of Norwegians to a small town to take him down. We had Dave Hill on the show a bunch of months ago, and he talked about the book, so go listen to that interview. But very fun book, very ridiculous. I love the comedy that it just keeps leading into. And I also love, I mean, this is just my preferred type of comedy, taking metal people and having them deal with, like, very banal, sweet, cute little things. That is such my preference versus, like, let's make it ultra-violent, just in terms of comedy. So this is hitting me exactly the right way.
Yeah, agree. And there's no comic out there that where you can hear the author's voice as strongly as Dave. It helps because we know Dave and have had him on the show recently. But like, it's just present in every line, and that's really fun and funny. He has a great sense of humor, a weird sense of humor, and you see it played out perfectly in this comic. It's a great read.
And last but not least, Radiant Black, number 35 from Image Comics, written by Kyle Higgins and Joe Clark, art by Eduardo Ferragato and Marcela Costa. Radiant Black is dealing with a baddie who comes from the alternate universe that was destroyed during the last big Catalyst War arc. He wants to take him down for what his alternate double did in that universe. He blames him for it. And like I said in the last issue, it's just nice to have a villain here who is more than a match for Radiant Black, that, not to contrast it with Transformers, has like a very clear mission statement and purpose and what he wants to do. It builds really nicely throughout, makes things dangerous. There's often, even though I really like this book, often been a sense of like, whoop, that bad guy's doing a thing. Well, he's gone now. Let's go back to the action. This like really focuses it up in a big way. And this arc has been great.
Yeah, I think the book really refocused after their big event last year, I guess that was, or ended early this year. And but this book continues to move at a crazy pace. I feel like this book, the characters, everything changes quickly. In this comic, the villain goes from being this scary mystery to, like you're saying, very clear in his mission and someone that they're like calling bullshit on like pretty quickly. And I like that. It's refreshing to have a comic that can confidently move quickly through what's happening and keep the action at the same pace as the storytelling. And that's what this book does the best, I think.
And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, as well as for ad-free versions of the podcast, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comics, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
And I think I speak for both of my co-hosts when I say, stay horny, yum yum.
Our sister, I'm going to bring forward and yours and give it to you now. And he said, oh, wow, that's great. Thank you. That's so generous of you, Carl. That's great. But his wife, my sister-in-law, went ballistic. She said, this is too much money. This is wrong. I don't want anything to do with it, and stormed out of the room. And I thought, well, that's not what I expected. Oh, my God. So I realized from that that this was not an easy thing to do. So I learned a lesson from that, and I knew that I had to do this authentically. I had to do it right. Otherwise, it was not going to work. So that happened. And then the third thing that happened was that I was looking at my financial statements, and I had more money there than I was really using. It was sitting there. I mean, it was growing, making profits and so forth, but it wasn't being used. I wasn't using it for me. I wasn't using it for things that I really cared about, not for my people. So I thought, well, if I have all this money now, why should I wait until I die? Why don't I bring it forward? And then, you know, it was a long process for me to come around to that, but that's what finally started this. And I said, well, I'll do it now.
Let's back up just a bit. Tell us a little bit about your new book. What is The Happiness Experiment?
Well, this is a recording of the real events with real people who I decided that I would bring forward the inheritance, the money I had for them in my will, and made it a prequest. So it was a chunk of money that they were going to get while they were still young enough to enjoy it, and I was still alive to see it happening. So I saw what they were doing. So when I sat down with them, I talked about money and happiness and how one can connect. And I said, look, I'm going to bring this forward to and give it to you. But what I want from you is a plan so that you use this money. So it's really a big benefit for you. I don't want this to overwhelm you. And they said, what kind of plan? I said, I want a happiness plan. And they said, a happiness plan? What's that? So you know, nobody seems to have a happiness plan. But it's one of the most important plans you can get. And it doesn't have to be very complex. What is it that makes you happy? What values do you want to pursue? You know, what goals and dreams do you have? And you can pursue them. And so I got them to write a happiness plan. And then when I saw the plan, I gave them all the money all at one time. And so then they took it and I watched them with their plan. I saw all their plans, what they did and how they became happier. And so, you know, that had to be written about. So, because I wanted other people to see what they did so that they too could do the same thing.
Which prequest is the most unique one you've come across?
Well, it was a very, very painful and sad story because two dear friends of mine had a beloved daughter and she was hit head on by a drunk driver and killed. She happened to be 8 months pregnant at the time, so that killed the granddaughter too, and also their daughter. They were totally, totally wiped out, devastated, and they died emotionally. They had decided that they could never be happy again, that it would be wrong to be happy. They didn't deserve to be happy because their darling daughter had been killed. Tremendously painful, awful, awful story. So they were grieving 6 years later. And I met with them and I told them how much they had added to my life and how much I was so grateful to them and that I wanted to express the gratitude. And I put them in my will and they could accept that. And I said, but I want you to have it now. And they said, oh, no, no, we can't accept it. They turned it down. They turned it down. Well, we worked. And I said, look, I'm leaving it open. So several months later, I think his wife persuaded him to do it, actually, you know. And, you know, so they said, okay, we'll do it because if we're going to wait until you die, why not do it now? And they did it. And it wasn't the money, interestingly enough. They said it was the coaching that made the big difference. That changed their mind, their mindset from being so negative, you know, we'll never be happy again. We don't deserve to be happy. And the coach turned their thinking, their mindset around and said, look, you know, it can be, you can be happy again. And they started to get the mindset of happy people. And now you cannot believe what these people, they're traveling all over the world. They're in Tahiti right now. They climbed Kilimanjaro. These people are loving life. And it was a major change. That is one of the most heartfelt, wonderful results of the. And in a sense, she said, the wife said, this prequest changed, saved my life. Because we were no longer living. We were dead. And this brought us back to life.
Yeah, I mean, dealing with grief, and many of us have, I have, you know, when you're in those depths, it can be really difficult to find your way out of it. And, you know, often it looks like there isn't a way out of it. And, you know, sometimes you want a map, right? And it looks like this concept could be a good map for you if you're that. It sounds like it was for these folks. I always like to end interviews by asking, is there anything that I didn't ask that I should have?
How can my listeners benefit from this book? What should they do? What would be good for them? And so I'll answer that question. First off, think about happiness. Think about being happiness. Do you deserve to be happy? And you can be happy, but you have to make it as a choice. I'm going to increase my happiness. Just that, if you make that realistically, I want to and I'm going to increase my happiness, that choice. And then talk to people about it. Talk to a husband or wife or a girlfriend or a friend, a therapist or coach. Talk to somebody about it and say, look, I made the decision that I want to be happier and I'd like you to help me create a happiness plan. And then work on it. And it's not that hard, but it is challenging, but it's a wonderful exercise. And if they do it, I guarantee they will increase their happiness. I guarantee it.
Carl Barney is the author, and the book is called The Happiness Experiment, A Revolutionary Way to Increase Happiness. Carl, where can people find the book?
Wherever books are sold, and it's now available for pre-order from Amazon, and they can go to thehappinessexperiment.com, and they can pre-order it there, and I hope they will.
Carl, thanks so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. It's been fun.